Welcome to D-Backs Podcast.
The future.
Technology and stuff.
This is the official podcast of the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Sports, 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 sports.
From the field to the front office, the ballpark to the broadcast booth, it's time to talk D-Backs baseball.
Just think about baseball.
Here are Greg Schulte and a high drive to left. Back she goes. And Steve Berthew.
Look at Chris Owens. Go get it.
Play ball.
From spectacular Salt River Fields at Talking Stick here in Scottsdale, Arizona, this is D-Backs Podcast, the official podcast of the Arizona Diamondbacks. As we tape this, it's Wednesday afternoon, January 21st. D-Backs pitchers and catchers will have their first official workout right here on February 20th. So we are a month away, people, and we are excited. Welcome to Episode 6. I'm Steve Berthew. Different feel to the show this week. First, there was Steve McGarrett. Then there was Thomas Sullivan Magnum. Now there is Greg Schulte. The Gubna is not here today. He and his wife Nancy are vacationing in Hawaii, Leo, part of the Gubs preseason preps. Leo Gilmartin is here as always.
You know, I look forward to your intros because I have to wait to the end to know where you're going with it.
That's the way the broadcasts are, too.
Yeah. And
what's he saying?
So I got you to the Hawaii 5-0. I like it. I'm good. It's bittersweet because we obviously miss the Gub, but we get to say hello to another friend.
That's right. Just to make sure this show is not the podcast equivalent of a deflated football, the show's always timely. Ably filling in today, we're very glad to have with us former Major League pitcher, one-time Diamondback starter, and now lead analyst on our Spanish-language radio broadcast. In 2010, he led the Diamondbacks in starts and innings pitched. Rodrigo Lopez is co-hosting. Welcome, friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Steve. Thank you, Leo, for this introduction. I was going to take my hat off, but since nobody's watching
us. We're very informal here.
Yeah, very informal. But, happy to be here. Going to be my second year right now with the organization, with the family of Diamondbacks. And, you know, it's been pretty fun. Last year with Oscar, with Richard Sainz, call him Chico,
yep.
That we always having a good time and looking forward for this coming season, 2015, a few weeks for see these guys show up here at Salt River Fields and spring training.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because you show up here and, this place has been pretty quiet the last few weeks. We've been coming here a while now and you'll see the occasional person. But today, Rodrigo, A.J. Pollock is over there running around. Patrick Corbin is throwing. Brad Ziegler's rehabbing his knee. And down on the other field, being watched by Tony La Russa, Dave McKay, Chip Hale, Yasmani Tomas here today, taking ground balls at third and hitting. Glenn Sherlock throwing batting practice right now. So we're tucked into a little corner here. We're still a month away from pitchers and catchers, yet this place is buzzing, isn't it?
Yeah, also seeing Bronson Arroyo working on someone's shoulder or elbow exercise with our trainer, Kershaw. I went to, I don't know when was the last time I was here, but seems like it hasn't changed anything. So last time I was here in the spring training, I can see a lot of activity, and it's good. It's a good time. People want to be ready. I know it's a lot of things to do before and during the season, but things like the players are prepared and they want to be ready.
Yeah, it's about that time, it seems like. Well, what was it like for you? Or guys feel like they want to go? When did you start to get the feeling as a player that, all right, enough already, I need to go throw some and I'm ready to go? When in the calendar year do you kind of feel that way?
Well, after the season, most of the team I was into, we never made the playoffs, so I always got that. We never had had more time of rest. So I usually take four to 6 weeks to rest totally baseball, like mentally, physically. So take a couple of vacations, but one start to go probably to a local gym or just jog around your house or the closest park. But once you get into baseball, it's about 2 months before spring training start, because now it's not about getting ready during spring training. It's be ready in the spring training to compete and to be ready for the season. Even on those years when I was named the opening day starters of the Baltimore Orioles, that probably, I could say, okay, I got my job secure, but you want to do the best. You want to do the best performance. And since the first outing, you want to go 6-7 innings. So in order to give the best to your team. So I think, you know, take 2 months before the season start. It's good to start. And, you know, it's a player, you kind of miss the environment. Mm-hmm. Be on the field, chat with your teammates, you know, play catch. All those little things that you won't have the same feeling doing somewhere else, I think is when you start to go back. And also being home and, you know, dealing with the kids and your wife.
You had enough of that, huh?
Yeah. You say, all right, I got to make excuses to go on the field.
I got to go work out.
That may be a two-way street. They may be asking you to find something to do as well.
Oh, yeah.
Honey, isn't it about time you started working out? Well, Rodrigo, 11 years in the big leagues. We'll talk to him in a moment about his career. And still, in a sense, pitching as of a couple of weeks ago. We'll talk about that. Episode 6 here, D-backs podcast. Available for free download, both dbacks.com and on iTunes here at Salt River Fields on Wednesday. Usually a quiet day around here, but as we mentioned, we have a lot of guys working out here. Many of them are pitchers who are rehabbing. Rodrigo mentioned Bronson Arroyo. Saw Patrick Corbin out here. Brad Ziegler is here as well. Pitched with that bad left knee for quite a bit last season. Brad finally had to be shut down. Microfracture surgery in mid-September. He will join us as our guest later in the show. We'll also have news from around the league. Busy week in terms of trades and free agent signings, and we'll talk about deferred money. How about Max Scherzer?
Again.
Are you getting any money? Money still rolling in?
No.
That's how we were able to get them. 2015. Now, Leo, I know you're excited about this. The Zips are out.
Yeah, I heard Zips, and I was thinking of the sports bar here locally.
Or the Akron
and
Zips.
So my enthusiasm was a little false.
As usual. Yeah, as usual. Anyway, 2015 Zips are out. We'll look at what that is and give you the numbers as it pertains to the Diamondbacks. Sabermetric Smackdown looks at the best way to measure a pitcher's walks and strikeouts. And as always, we'll check what's on the Twitter. But we're here with Rodrigo Lopez, 11 years in the major leagues, broke in with the Padres in 2000, 5 years with the Orioles, a year at Coors Field with the Rockies, a lot to talk about there. Also, Phillies, Diamondbacks, Cubs, 81 career wins, a 15-game winner in Baltimore twice, also led the league in losses twice. So you've really had some ups and some downs here. 7-16 during his one season with the Diamondbacks in 2010. You've accomplished a lot. I mean, as you mentioned, a couple of 15-win seasons, opening day starter. When you look back at your career, what were the highlights for you?
Yeah, probably my first season and my first season with the Baltimore Orioles probably were my highlights. Mm-hmm. I got 2 15 win season. I got 114.
2002 and 2005. You won 15 games in the major leagues.
That's correct. Yeah. You know, pitching against the Yankees, they got the CG and Yankee Stadium. A lot of my wins come from the Yankees and Boston. I mean, I think those are more the good memories they have while I was pitching my career. And I got good memories in Mexico. I mean, mm-hmm. we just been talking about a little bit of my career here in the States, but also in Mexico during winter, which most of the Latin players like to go out there and do, instead of prepare themselves to the next coming season, they use the winter leagues as a preparation. So I did that a couple times, and some of my accomplishments I did during my career also were in Mexico, in the Caribbean World Series.
Because you're from Mexico.
Because I was from Mexico, born and raised in Mexico, Mexico City.
Did you feel... almost maybe a responsibility or an obligation to go and kind of give back and play in the league in the winter?
Yeah, I kind of get something back to the fans because for the team I've been playing in winter, which is the Tomateros de Culiacán, is the tomato growers, is the name of the team. And they see me grow as a player. I've been there. I belong to that team since I was 19 years old since 1996. That was my first year over there as a rookie. So I made my big league debut in 2000. So I already got 4 years in that league before I make my debut. And ever since I belong to that team, I also play this year at the first half of the season. So
now, I mean, that's interesting because I sort of hinted at that a moment ago, and I'm glad you brought it up. When did you retire as a major league player?
It would 2013. That was my last. That was my last spring training. I was trying to make it the team with the Philadelphia Phillies on 2013. That didn't happen. So I went down to Mexico City Summer League, which is different than a Winter League. I went to Summer League to participate with the Diablos Rojos, which is the Mexico City team.
They're a great team, right?
I've
heard of them. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Those are probably the best organization in summer.
Now, we're at that point, were you thinking I'll still get a call, the phone will still ring, let's keep this thing going and see what happens?
That was my idea going down there to, you know, keep myself active. And at one point say pitching is always needed in baseball. So right now it's not a spot for me in AAA because the time when I was caught in the Philadelphia Phillies organization, everybody was full. So I went down to Mexico and tried to stay active in order to get back to the big leagues. And, as you know, there's sometimes you got your personal goals that you want to achieve. Like, I got 81 wins in the big leagues, so I always had this goal to reach 100 wins in the big leagues or reach my service time for 10 years. So I was short for a year and a half, 2 years. So I always got something to motivate me to get back to the big leagues. And didn't happen on 2013 and decided that was enough, you know, decided like, okay, this is enough. As people know, when you have kids that go to school, at least I don't like my kids moving around as right. far as the school because I feel that they feel comfortable to build some confidence in themselves on going to the same school. So every year, pretty much, I move to city to city.
Yeah.
And I had to wait until they go to vacation to meet me. So the time I was spending with my kids wasn't enough. So I say, all right, I guess my goals are starting to go away, but I'm starting to sacrifice my family more. So I say, all right, enough is enough. So 2013, that was my last, that was my year that I retired of playing summer league.
So then you settle here and hook up with the Diamondbacks.
Exactly. You know,
did you live here before at all? Had you been? I'm sure you've been here at some point, but
yeah. I'm moving here. I'm moving to the Valley in 06, and 2006, and moving to the Valley here. And I was going to different cities to play ball. But in 2010, as you mentioned before, I played here for the Diamondbacks.
Right.
And you know, met a lot of people, made a lot of friends. And one day playing golf, we got this conversation with Chico, with Richard Sainz, and that's how I get back to the family of the Diamondbacks. You know, I was pretty fortunate to go out there and shoot 120 on my golf
and still get the job.
Yeah.
I would like to say that year he pitched here in 2010, his numbers were deceiving. He really battled. 7 and 16.
But led the team in starts and innings pitched. What was that 1 year like as a Diamondback?
That was battle the whole time since the first day enjoyed the team and in camp because I was a minor league invite into the big league camp.
Worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. Brandon Webb, it was trying to get back. I think his shoulder never was the same after that surgery. So I got the opportunity, and I was also fine. For a spot with another two rookies, they gave me another chance to be in the big leagues, and I was doing pretty well. I think, or my belief is that only August, that was my bad month with all the numbers and all the losses came, and at the end, I reached the 200 mark, but my ERA, it was exactly 5. I thought to pitch in a Chase Field, I say under 5 could be pretty decent for the type of pitch I have.
You were right on the line.
On the line. I remember I pitched the last game of the season in Dodger Stadium, and it was the fifth inning, the two outs, and that was I was 199 and two-thirds. Matt Kemp stepped to the plate. Runners on second base or runners on first and second. So that was my last batter. That was my last batter to reach my 200 mark innings. And already on the scoreboard in the Dodger Stadium, it shows 5.00.
So you're out there calculating ERA in the middle of the game. That's fantastic. So what happened?
So I make the pitch. It was in the slider. He hit a little bit of his bat, and it was a fly ball to left field. So like.
So you're thinking. So,
no, and I was also, this got to be under five. My ERA is going to be under five.
So teammates rushed out on the field.
Yes, champagne.
Then I see my numbers and say, well, it's still five. It didn't go down. So I did the math, and it was like 4.9995.
Oh, that roundup gets you every time.
Yeah, so I was like, okay. So, but I mean, nothing that was going to change my next contract or anything like that. But, you know, I thought it was a good thing to accomplish. After that year, that at the end, that was pretty difficult.
It was a tough year.
Yeah. AJ Hinch got a hard time with the bullpen. I think the bullpen that year, we switched closers a lot of times. The starters went 6-7 innings every time because all the bullpen. And it was fun living, living in your own house, sleeping in your own bed that year. You know, had a chance to be part of the rotation with Dan Heron, Ian Kennedy, with Edwin Jackson. Those guys are doing pretty well.
Yeah.
So I meet a lot of friends, man, a lot of friends. Miguel Montero still, you know, talk to him once in a while. And it was a great year, you know, for as far as personal accomplishment. I mean.
So what do you make of the 2015 Diamondbacks?
What
do you think? What about all the changes? You walk around here, and I'm walking in to go find Leo, and we're kind of tucked into a corner here, right near the what do they call this field? The stretching? It's got a name.
We literally see guys out here running.
Yeah, the stretching and the running and the whole thing. Yeah.
Well, definitely we're going to be a good team on broadcasting for sure.
Well, that goes without saying.
We got that at least on Spanish language anyway. But what do you think about all the changes? Because it's exciting around here. Tony La Russa right now is out there watching Yasmani Tomas hit. I mean, there are a lot of new guys here. There's a new feeling. What do you think about that?
No, definitely got to be pretty excited. I mean, I'm excited to see all those guys in action, see them working. I mean, last year I think most of the moves that the Diamondbacks did, that was in the front office. First, like hiring Tony La Russa, and then bring David Stewart on board, and all his. We got a new assistant now, JJ Potts and Randy Johnson, a Hall of Famer.
Derek Hall's staff keeps growing. He's got the biggest staff on the team.
So they did some moves. They bring two Cuban guys that, you know, the Cubans have been doing well. Most of them have been either. They've been in the highlights, either the All-Star teams or they've been named a Rookie of the Year. I mean, they bring in something to MLB. So now we got two potential All-Star players that we can have in our staff. So that's something that I'm looking forward to seeing how they're gonna adjust themselves. They were born and raised in Cuba. Different that a little bit different that the guys who was born here in Florida, and I think that's something attractive for fans and for people that are involved in baseball. So, and we got new pitchers, Helixson, Robbie Ray. That's a little bit everything. I mean, it's we are in a difficult division with the Dodgers and with San Francisco, but still, we got good prospects, Peter O'Brien, all those kind of guys that we waiting to come up here. Archie Bradley last year, you know, we talk about him a lot last year. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it. Hopefully, this year it's already mature to be here in the big leagues. And that's a lot to see. Since the spring training, I think as a fan, if you want to see how the people develop, how they change, in a short period of time, it's a good time to come and start to see your players, your team, and that's a good time to see how the organizations are built.
Yeah, because you read so much about these guys in the off season. This, especially at this facility, which is designed and built for fan access. I mean, you're not roped off here. You are right there walking through the fields on the paths here, watching these guys as they go about their business. So this is the best time, as Rodrigo said, I think, Leo. Come on out and see for yourself. See these guys in person. We're about a month away from that.
Yeah, they designed this place specifically for fan access so they can do this. And this, to a lot of people, and myself included, is one of the most exciting times of the year, because there's so much hope and optimism, and you get to see all these people that you read about in the off season and saw some highlights. You get out and actually see them, and you can watch as much video as you want, which a lot of us do, but when you get to lay eyes on them and be that close to them, it's a really cool feeling.
Like that happened to me today. I had obviously seen video on Yasmani Tomas and read all about him, and I walk in today down the path from the parking lot over there, and the first guy I see is Yasmani Tomas. And I'm like, wow, this guy is, I mean, he's built like a Mack truck, this guy. He's a big dude.
But what did you say to him? Did you say, hola?
That's why I had you here. Where were you when I needed you?
It was a short conversation. Short conversation.
But he was over there taking ground balls at third with Chip Hale and Tony La Russa and Dave McKay and Glenn Sherlock and everybody. So this is a very exciting time to be here. So make plans to come on out. Not open to the public yet. We want to emphasize that. Can't come out here and watch just yet. But we're a month away from doing that. So 2015 Diamondbacks, what do we think? We could talk about it all we want, but really, Leo, and I think you'll agree with me, you don't get a sense until you feed the numbers into a computer.
Exactly. Tom Candiotti likes to say nothing happens until the pitcher throws the ball. In reality, nothing happens until the numbers are thrown in the computer
and then
Bert looks into his crystal ball.
Well, I don't do it. Dan Szymborski does it. So let's just keep going and do the zips here. Now, I know you are for sure asking, and I'm sure Rodrigo's wondering what the hell I'm talking about.
Of course, always.
Well, yeah, nothing new there. Zips. This is from Dan Szymborski, whose work appears at ESPN. It's on FanGraphs. He did these for a site called Baseball Think Factory. They're all over, and they just came out this week. Zips are computer-based projections of performance. And what this is a very complex formula, and it projects both hitters and pitchers what they're going to do for the upcoming season. All the numbers get plugged into a computer. A lot of thought and math goes into this, and the computer then calculates it and spits out projected stat lines for every player for the upcoming year. And Dan's formula, just to give you a general idea, it weights the averages of the last 4 years of data, or if the player is older or younger, they only use 3 years to get a more accurate reading, and it regresses some numbers based on rates and percentages. It adjusts for things like aging and other trends, league averages, and so forth. And as far as predictive numbers go, it's a projection system that works about as well as any other. It's always fun. Look, this is not etched in stone by any means, but it's fun here in the middle of January. Hey, the zips are out. Let's take a look at what the computer spit out and see what some guys might do this year. So take into account injuries, lost playing time to a platoon, a rookie arrives on the scene. That changes the equation at a certain position. So there are all kinds of factors here. But based on the formula, this is some of the projections for 2015. I can see you're breathless with anticipation.
Can't wait. You're on a fantasy team. You're ready.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in fantasy, if you're playing fantasy baseball, zips are a great tool. And again, you can find them at fangraphs.com. It's going to project what each guy's going to do. So let's start with Goldie, because he's kind of an easy one. You know what Goldie's going to do. We're aware. According to zips in 2015, Goldie will hit .283, 28 home runs, 95 RBIs. Your thoughts? You look underwhelmed.
Sounds about right.
About right.
You know,
Makes sense.
My thoughts of seeing Goldie is 30 home runs, 100 RBIs.
Yeah, I see the 28's a little low for me, especially in our ballpark. So I'll take the 95 RBIs. Certainly, I know he will. A.J. Pollock, who I just saw 10 minutes ago out there running around, he looks fantastic. A.J. Pollock, also 283, 9 homers, 15 stolen bases. I think A.J.'s got more power than that for me. I see him as a, if he's in the middle of the lineup, as more of a run producer. And this is a great question for you, Rodrigo, because obviously you watched him pitch or play all last year, except when he was hurt. Do you see A.J. Pollock, who we know can run, as a top-of-the-order guy, one or two, or do you see him, and this is more the guy I saw, I thought we saw before last year, before he got hurt, do you see him as more of a power guy, a middle-of-the-order bat, say hitting fifth or sixth somewhere? Is he a top-of-the-order guy for you or middle-of-the-order guy?
I like him the top-of-the-order guy. I mean, I like his velocity. After he came back for an injury, I think we see the truly A.J. Pollock, but still I like him being the top to lead the lineup, and he did a pretty good job. And adding that, if you got a power, as a pitcher, it's pretty difficult to pitch a guy like that.
Now, what about Ender Inciarte? Do you see him as the leadoff guy, and does that make you want him, if he indeed plays a lot of left field, and if he leads off, and at this point everything is an if, would you then move A.J. down and hit him and see if he can, you know, get to 15 homers and 80 RBIs, somewhere around there? You're not buying that?
No.
Okay.
I'm still with him, and, you know, it's a good option. Have Inciarte as a leadoff. He doesn't have the power that A.J. Pollock have, but still I got A.J. Pollock. Both are tremendous outfielders, but as far as the lineup, I go with A.J.
Gotcha. And left field's going to get really complicated, Leo, because if Tomas, they decide, is not the answer at third, then suddenly in left field you've got Tomas and Cody Ross and Ender Inciarte and David Peralta because they are committed to Pollock in center and Trumbo in right.
Well, that, I think, where you want to hit A.J., it depends so much on what our makeup of that lineup, that outfield is going to be, and is Ender going to be in, you know, in the starting lineup most nights, or is he going to, you know, if Tomas gets pushed to the outfield, does that put Ender back to a fourth outfielder role? So, I mean, I think a lot of that will be determined in the spring when you really start finding out where guys are going to slot and where they're going to play.
So, a lot of moving parts in this equation. Speaking of Ender Inciarte, Zips projects 31 stolen bases for Ender. Yasmani Tomas, you want to take a? Why don't you take a crack here? Let's turn you into our human Zips.
Oh, my goodness.
Let's project for Tomas, and I'll tell you how close you are. Just give me average home runs, RBIs.
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. I'll be a little, let's see, 252. You want home runs next?
Homers and RBIs.
14 and 72.
Rodrigo, what do you think?
Yeah, all right, 260.
Okay.
I'd see him 18 home runs, RBIs, I don't know, about 60 or something like that.
60. 60 is exactly what the computer spit out for RBIs. Yasmani Tomas, you were right on, my man. Tomas, 267, 21 homers, 60 RBIs. You'll take that.
Yeah, and I guess one of the questions I have for you on Zips, and one of the things I was trying to think in my mind is how much time is he actually spending up with the big league club? Is he breaking camp? Is it based on a full season? And how do they take factors in to that kind of stuff and injuries and how do they factor all that in?
It basically puts it, and I don't want to be incorrect about this. It's hard to take into account, as we mentioned, injuries or loss of playing time. So you basically have to project approximately what you think the guy is going to give you in terms of...
Well, then I say what Rodrigo said.
Out of the,
nice
yeah.
work.
Based on that adjustment, I go with Rodrigo.
Right.
That's a good move. Let's go with the number.
Because it's a guesstimate. Even the computer's just guessing here. And it's a fun thing to talk about on January. I just always like to look at the numbers and see what we're looking at.
The fact that he had to adjust himself to the big leagues, to the American system. I kind of add that, probably go a little bit lower on the RBIs because I'm seeing his swing. Again, we haven't seen person. I just seen videos, but I see him swing. Still, I think he got to make some adjustments.
Yeah. And I was thinking that with his batting average. I thought his first year, his batting average might be a little bit lower.
Leo and I actually, 20 minutes ago, were out watching him hit. Glenn Sherlock was pitching batting practice to Tomas in the cage. Dave McKay, Tony La Russa right behind. And Chip Hale, the new manager, is out shagging flies in right field. And Chip is standing out in right field. And you and I are almost behind the plate. And I can hear Chip from where we are standing saying to himself out in the outfield, easy power. Like he's just got this, you can see the look on his face. Because Tomas is just lacing balls to right center field. And it's just so smooth and effortless. And you can see the lower half is so thick. And that's it generates the power. And bang, bang, bang. He's firing them off to right field and right center. And I can hear Chip from way out there going, easy power.
Yeah. And it's that's going to be a difficult BP for him because – like you said, you got Dave McKay, you got Tony La Russa behind the cage, you got your new manager. You've been in the States all of 3 days, and you're trying to, everyone's
so much
going evaluating on. Every little thing you do, and that's going to be kind of tough.
And then Rodrigo, what about this? The great thing is that when Tomas steps out of the box for a moment to kind of catch his breath, he turns around and Tony La Russa is standing 3 feet behind him, speaking fluent Spanish. Tony, as we know, speaks fluent Spanish. Does that help at all?
Oh, yeah.
You've been in that position, too.
Sure, yeah. Definitely. I mean, Tony La Russa has a feature in baseball all over the world, right?
Right.
I had an experience with him when my first time in St. Louis, had a chance to talk to him a little bit, and all of a sudden he started speaking fluent Spanish. So that was a good team for me. You know, I was pretty excited to talk to Tony in Spanish, but definitely as a player and seeing a guy to speak in the same language, because you come from a foreign country, right? You came here to stay. You think like everybody speaks English, like you won't hear Spanish again.
Right.
You think like everybody will speak. So you came here, I mean, the tension of you want to make a good impression, your first impression to the team that he just gave you $64 million. I mean, you want to do the best. And all of a sudden, Tony La Russa came and talked to you in Spanish and see how good people Tony La Russa is. I think that will give you, that will help a lot to relax, to feel more confident, and definitely to do to make a better performance of what you're doing.
And the Diamondbacks have made this a priority to get not only Yasmani Tomas, but Yoan Lopez, who may be with the big league club as well, comfortable, because they've brought in Ariel Prieto, the former major league pitcher, as a coach and a translator. He was in Oakland with Yoenis Cespedes, and now he'll do kind of that same job here with Tomas and Lopez at some point. How big a difference does that make to have a guy like the Dodgers have done that with Puig, to have a guy who's with you all the time, and can not only get you through a day on the field, but, maybe help you order a meal in a restaurant or use an ATM, whatever it is. How big a difference does that make?
I never get that.
You're on your own, huh?
No, I think it's a big difference to adjust to the culture, to the game. And everything is for you performance as best as you can on the field. It's not easy for a foreign player to come here and, just like you say, to order a meal, to get into the clubhouse. I mean, to read what's going on with the drills, with the next day workout, all those little things. Probably for people that have been living here or their whole life, or for us that we already know the language, and all those little things probably does. That doesn't matter, but for us, it's make our life easier, and it's less that you have to worry. So it's very important to have them on interviews, on how to act on and off the field. It's different the culture that we live in the clubhouse here in the States, or in American baseball, that we live in Latin America countries.
Right.
So all those little things that will help them to blend into a team in the state and make it easy. I think a good example is Yasiel Puig, probably. His attitude nobody says anything to him in Latin America, but here, and we didn't take it. We take that sometimes unrespectable for the other players or for your own players, the things that he does, you know. And those little things probably will help him to feel better and feel more welcome to his new team.
We'll wrap up with the Zips in just a second, but I want to ask you one more thing about that. Some of these guys play in, say, the World Baseball Classic and some of these other things. So this isn't completely alien territory for them. But when you're playing in the Cuban League, or as you did for so many years in the Mexican League, what are those international league games and environments like compared to a major league environment?
Well, during the WBC, it's pretty much the teams that I've been into pretty much are big league environment, since most of them are big league players. But like, right, if you go and play like summer or winter, you will see how much of the difference are those environments.
Because you're playing for Diablos Rojos,
yeah,
and Tomas playing for Industriales for a while in Cuba. What are like the real heart of it? Like your average league game in those leagues, what's that like versus an average game, say, on a Tuesday night here at Chase Field?
For example, a workout are a little bit different. You know, the pitchers get the 2 hours before the batters, right? They gotta do the workout, the stuff like that. We are more louder in the clubhouse as well, in the crowd. You know,
a little more boisterous.
Yeah, like come on, and when we hit a home run, we used to go out there and high-five. I don't see like old-timers like go sometimes just right next to the batter box and high-five the guy to hit a home run. Now we wait here in the state, we wait in the clubhouse in the dugout to high-five that guy. Those are kind of the difference. Are over there, there's a rule where the local sound or the guy who played the music, this is a rule that he can let the music play until the pitcher set. Here we don't see that.
Oh, okay.
So they can be as loud as they can in the stadium and everything once you get set, and then they have to shut down the music, made the pitch, and then the music going
crank
on.
Crank it up again, huh?
Yeah.
It's like an NBA game.
Yeah.
It's really unique. I got the opportunity to go to Mexico City for the WBC in, was it 2009, I think it was? And I'm not sure if you were part of that WBC, if you pitched for Mexico.
Yeah.
So he's in Mexico City working for the MLB in those games, and Cuba was there. And one of the interesting things were about that. So we had rules similar to MLB when music has to stop, going into the box, all that stuff. And it's such a different, you know, with the noisemakers and the thing. And the second day we're there, and I'm in charge of all the game operations and stuff like that.
You are?
Yes.
Wow.
That's why they haven't gone back to Mexico City. at Foro Sol Stadium.
No Leo.
And so we're
no Leo.
We're sitting there, and we have a
what's Spanish for no Leo?
That's pretty much it.
Yes, exactly.
No Leo.
And so so I'm in charge of all that, and we have the music up in the press box, and I go there the second day, and all of a sudden I look out in the outfield, and there's a band setting up, and I'm not just talking about, you know, I mean, this guy's got amplifiers, a drum set, we got guitars. And they're prepared to play the entire game.
So it's nuts.
And this is
huh?
in the stands. And
it's
this,
yeah,
and
nuts.
It's, and that's just the way. That's the way it was.
Yeah.
So it was really cool to see that.
So here, the competition level, I'm guessing, is better, but the environment is maybe a little more clinical. And so, if you've already played in that cauldron of noise and distraction in some of these other leagues, then is it then easier to play here and just concentrate on the pitcher or the batter?
To me, yeah. Playing in the Tomateros, so we were talking earlier about it, 4 years before make my debut into the big leagues, I think to me that was a good time to mature to get to the big leagues. It's a lot of pressure from go to Triple A and make your debut. I mean, you're used to pitch for 12,000 people. You go to the big leagues, you have to pitch in front of 40,000 people. So they're not as loud as in Mexico, but in Mexico or in Latin America, they get pretty loud. They get sometimes they get pretty personal, or what they're yelling at you and stuff like that. I mean, you get used to that, and you learn how to control your emotions when that happens. So you get into the big leagues, you had a little bit of that experience.
So you're almost, in a sense, a seasoned pro then, if you've played in these leagues like you did and like Tomas has and like Lopez has. So I would think that bodes pretty well for these guys coming in here.
Yes, that's the little things that they've been different. You know, in the clubhouse, probably, as I say, sometimes the players in Latin America, they got their own boombox and play the music as loud as they can. And there's a guy three lockers away from you doing the same thing. If for us, it's like, okay, that's I respect your space. You respect my space and whatever. You probably don't even understand what the music say, but for them, it's normal. Okay, you came here into the state. I don't think it's pretty polite to doing that. I mean,
you're not blasting your own boombox.
Exactly.
The guy three lockers down.
I've been in teams where the music is not allowed into the clubhouse.
By the managers.
In order to not provoke any altercation and stuff like that. So it's pretty smart. So I think that's respect. And I think that word means a lot, you know, and it can have different definitions and different countries. And I think sometimes it's where we had to adjust to the new culture when we came here to the state.
It's so interesting to see the way, say, a guy comes up in America, signs with the Diamondbacks, goes to Missoula or goes to Visalia, comes up that way, or Yasmani Tomas, who gets out of Cuba, goes to Haiti, goes to the Dominican, works out, signs here. He's played in those leagues. The two paths seem so different, but they end up in the same place. I'm interested to see what the end result is here. But I think based on everything you've told us, that these guys have, in a sense, really paid their dues and played in some difficult environments.
Yeah. And Cuban guys, I think they got a lot of an international tournaments.
And the league, if you're, say, Lopez, Yoan Lopez, 21-year-old kid, he's playing in the Cuban League against guys in their 30s and so. So do you think that helps their pitchers become a little more advanced? Because that's the word on Lopez, is the makeup for a 21-year-old kid is a lot further along than had he been, say, growing up here in the States.
Yeah, I think it will help him. To me, it helped me a lot pitching in Mexico with all those veteran there guys that never had a chance to play in the States. But they've been playing in Mexico forever, so, and also guys that you're going to face. So you learn how to pitch, not just how to throw as hard as you can. You learn how to pitch. You learn how to read the batters, what they want to do, how kind of swing they are. Because just like you said, there's not like a double A or triple A in Cuba. You go into the big leagues, and if you be successful, you stay. If not, you go back. And
that's it. You're out.
Yeah. So I think it will help them a lot.
And the Diamondbacks will be in Hermosillo, right? Again, did we finalize that? Is that a done deal?
They're gonna. I think they're traveling to Mexico today and tomorrow. I think Chico's actually leaving today, and Derek's leaving tomorrow for an announcement.
Lock that down. Yeah, so no announcement here on this show, but we are hopeful that they can get that worked out and play an exhibition game in Mexico. What does that mean to the folks in Hermosillo to have the Diamondbacks and Rockies come down and play a game there if they get that all worked out? Is that a big deal?
I think it's a big deal seeing the big league players come and play in the land, especially the Diamondbacks, which is the favorite team in Sonora, which is the state that borders Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Big following there.
Wow, okay. Big following. They've been doing that for quite a bit. No, I don't know when the last time before this one, but
I know we obviously didn't go last year with the trip to Australia, but we've gone there several times.
And even they make a game with the national team that was going to go to the WBC against Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
I think I started one of those games. So for them, it's it's very convenient to see their, the idols, Paul Goldschmidt, Miguel Montero, it is a good one. And if Luis Gonzalez is there, and even if he's not playing, I think he's
Gonzo is welcome everywhere. Yeah. You find that out quickly around here. Gonzo has the red carpet rolled out for him no matter where he goes. It's amazing, and justifiably so. Well, I think this has been a fascinating discussion about the environment that some of these other players play in and how that might affect Tomas and Lopez here. So that's been a great discussion, but it's time now to welcome – We got a big time guest here today. This is not only do we have Rodrigo, but we got a big guest coming in right now.
Absolutely, we don't go halfway here. We get the big names, and today is no exception.
All right, let's get right to it.
All right, friends, it is time.
Ladies and gentlemen, will you welcome one of the magnificent figures?
He's so good.
My guest.
It's always a pleasure when our guest drops by.
I want to ask you a bunch of questions, and I want to have them answered immediately.
One of the guys here, busy rehabbing at Salt River Field, to Talking Stick. Brad Ziegler, how you doing?
Doing well.
How's the knee?
It's getting better, for sure. It's it's a process, and it's tough. This has been the toughest offseason I've had to endure.
Wow.
But it's definitely not something I want to go through again, so we want to make sure and do it right and not try to come back too quick and end up re-injuring it. But right now, every time I see the doctor, he says you're looking great, you're right on schedule. So I'm taking that like everything's going well.
It didn't go well for you with this injury for a while. Things gradually got worse. At first, they thought maybe he could avoid the surgery. Then we heard it was going to be arthroscopic, which is relatively minor. They're still going in there. But it turned out to be microfracture surgery. Can you give the folks an idea of what the doctors told you that they saw and what they actually did?
Yeah, the first time I realized that was a possibility was when I got my second opinion in Los Angeles. Dr. Elitrosh out there.
And we're talking a left knee, right?
Left knee, yeah. Okay. He did an x-ray and saw some bruising in the bone. And that's what concerned him, that he felt like there might be some bone-on-bone contact. And if that's the case, then that means there's no cartilage there, which means the microfracture is literally the only option other than knee replacement. They wanted, but it was something. There was no definite in the MRI that showed that there was no cartilage there. So they, he actually didn't know when Dr. Lee did the surgery. He didn't know until the middle of the surgery that the microfracture was going to be necessary until I was in there. So I went in thinking, like, kind of hoping for the 4 to 6 week rehab, and instead I got the 7-8 month rehab.
So you woke up and they said, we got some good news and bad news.
Well, I knew it was a possibility. That was the first time I woke up. The first thing I said, the nurse was there, and I said, did they have to do microfracture? And she said, yes. And I was like, oh, no.
Immediately you think, okay, there's 6 months.
Yeah, minimum. Yeah. Minimum. So, and it's, 6 months would be, on a calendar would be March 9th, because the surgery was September 9th. So that's a good target date to get back, at least, bullpens, et cetera. And then, ideally, I'm ready for opening day. And like I said, we don't want to rush back and, by trying to come back a little too quick and end up having to get something cleaned up and miss another 2 or 3 months, as opposed to making sure I'm ready to go. And if I, if I do end up missing a week or two in the season,
right,
then that's, if I pitch the last 5.5 months, I'd rather have that than try to come back too quick and end up missing a huge chunk of the year. But right now, there's no reason to think that's going to be the case. That, there's, like I said, everything's on track, and we're really hoping that everything will be ready to go for opening day.
That's great news. Give folks an idea of what you're actually doing right now. Like, what's the process when you come here just about every day?
It's 3 days a week as far as the rehab goes. And the main reason for that is it's so intense. It's kind of like working out. Like, you can't – if you do a lower body lift or an upper body lift, you can't do that every single day. It's a very strenuous, like, it's a way tougher leg program than I've ever had in my life.
Wow.
Even when I was healthy and just trying to condition my legs. I come in roughly 9 o'clock, 9:30. It's about 2.5 hours of leg strengthening stuff. And then, 15 minutes of bike, and then about 10 minutes of really intense workout the underwater treadmill with the jet pool.
Wow, that's the real deal, huh? That's big time.
That's when I get out of there. I've told them that 8 to 10 minutes is the hardest thing physically I've had to do in the last 10 years of my life.
So explain what's the setup? Because that facility's right here. We're 20 feet away from it.
Right.
What is that?
The jet pool is actually on the minor league side. Mm-hmm. And so we walk down there. It's got a floor that raises and lowers, and it raises all the way to the top. I step on it, and they lower me down about, you know, belly button high in the water. What that does is it alleviates some of the weight that my feet and knee have to bear. Turn the jets on. Like, initially, the jets were on, like, 25%. You know, we're going to go, like, 1 mile an hour on the treadmill. Now I'm at a full run. It's 6 miles an hour. You know, like I said, belly deep in water. And they've got the jets on 100%. Wow. And so I'll run for a minute. Then they'll kick it down to 3.5. Sorry, it's 5 miles an hour on the running. They kick it down to 3.5. And I do a side shuffle to the right for a minute. Side shuffle to the left for a minute, and then a backwards run for a minute. Then they kick it back up to 5, and I go through that cycle one more time.
So underwater on a treadmill with the bubbles coming at you.
Yeah, it's.
Wow. Do you ever have anything like that, Rodrigo?
Never, no.
But the jets are the intense part. You know, it's the treadmill and the water is not too bad by itself, but when they kick the jets way up.
But the resistance, the water put into your body. I mean. Just like you said, you might be in the best shape of your life. Right?
I mean, isn't everybody right now? Except for, I guess, Jeremy Guthrie tweeted last night that he is not in the best shape of his life.
That was the first one of the year, the best shape of the life tweets.
And I'll be honest, like, I don't – anybody that goes through a college conditioning program for a big school, I don't know how anybody is in better shape later in life than they are in college when you're – like, you're doing everything you can to make it, and we were running obscene amounts in college. And so I will never get back to where I was in college.
None of us will. I got news for you.
Yeah, as far as the best shape of my life. So, but I, you know, I understand the idea that guys feel great right now. They're, you know, and once, you know, especially once the Super Bowl hits, that it's kind of after the Super Bowl, like, all right, football season's over. It's baseball time.
That's right. The gate kind of opens up.
Yeah. So we, you know, everybody's, you know, we're 10 days from that, and you know, everybody's obviously excited since it's here in Arizona, but after that is when it really starts. Like, okay, I've got to really kick it in and baseball mode.
So. I'm sorry about the Chiefs, by the way.
Yeah, it was tough. We were the only team to beat the Seahawks and the Patriots this year. So,
yeah.
So there you know there's talent there, and we just, you know, our wide receiver core has got to change because it's.
Dwayne Bowe and those alligator arms probably driving you crazy.
That and a quarterback who doesn't throw the ball downfield. So we got to figure something out.
Now, here's a dumb question. Rodrigo, how critical was your left knee to you in the way you threw the ball? Because Brad obviously has a very different delivery. Is it a different effect? Is it more strenuous for one or the other? I mean, I'd be interested to see you two guys talk about that. Like, how obviously the knee is critical for everybody, but what difference does it make based on the way you threw versus the way that Brand throws?
Well, I think it's very important for any pitcher to have a strong bottom. You know, your legs are your foundation. I never had a problem with my knees, but the way I'm throwing, I was like, overhand. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was just a normal guy throwing right here. But the way the seaman throw is like, I think it's a lot of stress into your knees, into your hips, and that part of your body, right? In the left side of the body.
Do they talk about that with you at all?
Yeah, for sure. And that's what we've kind of figured out because right now I've been playing catch since December 1st, but it's all overhand. And because overhand and you can.
And you can throw overhand, by the way, just so folks know. That's how you started.
Right. And that's, I do all my long toss overhand. I throw my pickoffs. If I feel the ball back to me, I throw it overhand. So I do a lot of my throwing work to keep my arm strong as overhand. And whenever I do that, my left leg is actually pretty stiff. You know, whenever I throw, I don't have a lot of bend in my knee like a Tom Seaver did or whatever on that way out on that front leg. But that changed whenever I went to submarine. And when you can see pictures, you know, I've looked at pictures online and noticed how bent my leg is while I've still got the ball in my hand when I'm throwing submarine. There's a lot more strain on my front knee as a submariner than there was as an overhand pitcher. So right now, I told them I wanted to start throwing early this year, partially, number one, because my season ended a month early. But number two, I wanted to make sure my arm was ready to go when my knee was ready to go. I didn't want my arm to be behind.
Yeah, you really do have to coordinate it, don't you?
Right. And so I've been long tossing. I'm out to 200 feet now, and which is way further than I would normally be on January 20th. Normally, I hit that part about the 1st of February. But my arm feels great right now, and so just kind of taking it nice and easy. But like I said, the overhand throwing is not strenuous on that knee, and so it allows me to make sure my arm's in shape.
And also, your mechanics seems like you land on your right side, right? Like across, or
yeah,
you're not up in your front side much,
right?
Of it.
Right.
And as a overhand, you have to line up to where you want, inside or outside. So I think you don't think much, but on his the way he throws, I think he got to be pretty accurate on his timing to make your good pitch. So, and it's a lot of pressure on his knee and hips, where I believe.
Yeah, and especially whenever I, like, after I throw the ball, I fall to the right side. The reason is because I've got so much pressure on that knee that it kind of extends, and to get myself upright again to hopefully feel the ball coming back to me, I fall way to the right side because I've got all that weight on that left leg.
So you're talking about a left knee that's had some real wear and tear here over the years based on the way you throw.
Yeah, and especially, it may have never had an issue if I was an overhand pitcher.
Right.
But switching to this delivery, back in 2007, might have been when the damage kind of initially started, and it just gradually over time started wearing down.
I want to get to that in just a second, but it's important to point out you are as – sure a thing as there is coming out of a major league bullpen. No, really. I mean, from the games in Sydney when the season started through the end of June last year, 3-1, a 2.34 ERA, very typical Brad Ziegler season, opponents hitting 192 against you. Then the knee injury sometime in late June, right?
Yeah, 27th.
It was obvious to everyone that something was wrong. Because from July 1st through the end of the year, when you were shut down right after Labor Day, the ERA was 5.47. So you were really pitching through something here. What was that month or so like for you? Because it seemed to just keep getting worse and worse. What were you going through physically?
I honestly think the biggest thing, when I got on the mound, I really didn't feel it. I'd have adrenaline in the game, and I wouldn't feel the pain. But where I think it hurt me the most was I wasn't able to do my conditioning. I wasn't able to lift weights. I couldn't do anything with a lot of strain on that leg pregame when, we don't really have a lot of adrenaline. And so I think that's gradually over the course of the season, I just got weaker and weaker and weaker. And normally when you look back at, at pitch effects, my velocity in July and August is the highest it is all season. It's always, 86, 87.
You mean historically?
Right, right.
Right, okay.
Last year in August, I was throwing like 82. And that was the first indication to me, like, something's not right. Like, I'm having to be so pinpoint with my pitches. I've got zero room for error. And it's never had to be that way. Either they're figuring me out or something else is wrong. And when I was watching the video and I saw the velocity, I was like, okay, that's concerning to me, not because I'm trying to throw hard, but because it's just not where I'm normally at.
So it's not a, oh, my knee hurts thing. It's more of a what's going on kind
well,
of thing.
Initially it was an oh, my knee hurts, and that's when they said, you got to back off the conditioning and the weightlifting until we get this fixed. And so I didn't do it all the way until I gave up a ninth inning homer, I think, in D.C., And I was so frustrated. It was maybe it was the eighth inning. I don't know. It was a tying home run in a game, and I was so frustrated after I came out. I immediately went to the trainers and I said, I've got to do something to get my leg strong again. And I don't know what that is. I don't know what I can do. And they said, how's it feeling? I said, well, for the most part, it's feeling pretty good. But there are movements I do going upstairs, et cetera, where I still have pain. And they said, all right, well, let's try you on just a light conditioning, start you back like 6 sprints the next day, et cetera, and kind of work back into it. And I, the first thing I had initially noticed, even prior to when I felt the crackling in the knee and the severe pain, I had a pretty good lump on the back of my leg. And it was they call it a Baker cyst, just where a pocket of fluid. And we had had that drained right before the All-Star break. And then I went through, went through July and August when we were out in D.C. and I gave up that homer and I went and talked to him. I started running again. It was maybe 5-6 days into that program that cyst came back, and it swelled up again, and it put a lot of pressure in my knee. And, you know, so they drained it again and said, you know, that's a concern. Let's get another MRI and see if there's any change. And that's when you could see there had been some structural difference from the first one to the second one. It was just a little more worn down. There was more swelling. And so that was when we kind of started the process, like, you know, pretty soon I'm going to need to figure this out. And I tried to gut it out as long as I could. And I just got to the point where I really just felt like I didn't have anything left.
Yeah, I mean, we could see Rodrigo. I mean, we could see up in the booth. I mean, he's really gutting it out here. It just kind of went on and on for a while.
Yeah,
we
started
just trying
seeing,
to do the best you can.
We started different, just like you say, different particular pitching on the mound. Probably is the way he feels, and I think it's on nature of the baseball player or the pitchers. You're a competitor. You want to be out there, especially when you're having a good season. And once the adrenaline kicked in, you probably – don't feel like you have a pain, but actually your body will react, and probably those are a little things that you've been doing just perfect. Your body is not prepared for it, and eventually you start to get the results that you don't want. But mentally, you don't want to create any excuse. You say, you know, I'm ready. I don't feel anything. You think you're okay, but the things I've been learning now that I'm seeing the game from other perspective that you up there seeing every day and every day, you say, okay, it's this a little thing, something, little something here that probably hasn't realized. But and I think it happened to you, the right after the game, it comes the media and say, hey, is anything wrong? You don't say, oh yeah, my knee hurts. Or,
I didn't say anything for a long time.
Exactly.
And
then, yeah.
Is that hard? Is that hard to do?
Yeah, sure. But I mean, I really didn't feel. Looking back on it, it's easy to see like how my body got weaker and weaker over the course of the season. And I saw that at the end of the year, you know, in September, I'm like, okay, well, it makes sense that I'm not throwing as hard because I haven't lifted weights, I haven't been running, my legs aren't as strong as they normally are. But when I was going through it and pitching on the mound, I didn't feel it in the games. I felt it when we went out to do early throwing and stuff. But once I got a sweat going and adrenaline kicked in, I didn't feel it. And so I really didn't feel like that was the reason why I was struggling. And I still, like, it still boils down to executing pitches. Even if I'm throwing 82 instead of 86, I still got to execute pitches. Because I had several scoreless innings in that stretch. It wasn't
sure.
Like every single outing was horrendous. But it just didn't feel right. And finally, I was just like, I can't physically do this anymore.
Well, so much of this for you is the motion that you referenced a minute ago. I mean, you've been at this a while now. This is going to be your age 35 season. Didn't break into the big leagues until you were 28 with Oakland, first drafted by the Phillies, and Rodrigo spent some time with the Phillies. And you and I have talked about this on our Cup of Coffee show. It's always fun to talk about the evolution of how you got to be what you are now. Or from we kind of joked about the overhand long toss a minute ago. Can you run through the evolution of your throwing motion?
Sure. You know, I was always kind of a three-quarter guy. Even when I was an overhand pitcher, I wasn't straight over the top. Definitely not Cole Minter. Probably more like a Daniel Hudson arm slot. Mm-hmm. Didn't have his velocity. And that was the thing. I got up to AAA with Oakland, and they approached me and said, we think mentally you're ready to pitch in the big leagues. You do all the little things right. You're tough mentally. But we need to do something to separate you from other right-handed pitchers that throw 88 to 90 in the minor leagues. There's a lot of those guys. And so they said, would you consider dropping down full-time, moving to the bullpen?
Is there a term you prefer? Submariner?
Every time I say it, I change it. So
that's why I was asking.
Yeah, submarine sidearm. You know, whatever, like a girl. That
throws like a girl. Yeah. Okay, is that okay if I use that all year?
Sure.
Sure. All right.
So and that's
Rodrigo.
Not,
write that down.
I don't mean that in any way. Derogatory toward women at all. But as a fast pitch softball pitcher,
right. It's the same
motion. They throw overhand, and that's a lot of When you get heckled in the bullpen, a lot of them say that, like, Ziggler, this isn't a softball game.
Oh, you hear that, do you?
Yeah. In San Francisco, it's tough not to because they're about a foot and a half away from you.
Right there.
So,
yeah.
But I went to Instructs at age 26, Trevor Cahill.
Which is ancient.
Yeah, Trevor Cahill was 18, about to turn 19 in the same Instructs.
With Oakland. This is
yeah.
what he is. Yeah.
And so that was where he and I first met, and the first 3 weeks of that instructional league, I never picked up a baseball. It was always going through a dry motion just to get a feel for the delivery. And initially, they had me, like, knuckle scraping low, where if I wasn't on a mound, I would drag my fingers on the ground.
So you're just going through the motion, almost hitting your hand on the ground, no baseball.
Right. I did that for probably 3 weeks, then started throwing some bullpens, and then they let me pitch in, like, two instructional league games just to see some hitters. I went home for the offseason, came back the next year at spring training, and they brought me to big league camp. They cut me in the first round of cuts. Like, I pitched in one inning, I think. And
Brad, let me ask you this question real quick. So as a pitcher, you I'm looking for my target, mm-hmm. but you're changing your mechanics. So you were concentrating on your target, or you were concentrating on your arm slot?
For the first 3 years I did it, I was concentrating more on my mechanics than my location.
So whatever the ball.
Right.
Did you hit the mascot a couple of times?
I didn't, but it's surprising. But what happened at the end of that camp, at the end of minor league camp, they came to me and said, look, your velocity is not where we hope it is. We were thinking you'd be, mid 80s. I was throwing 79-80 from knuckle scraping. So they said, literally the last day of spring training, why don't you throw a bullpen and try raising up a little bit, kind of free your hips up a little bit where you're not collapsed so much and see if you can get a lot more of your lower half into your delivery. And I did it. They were gunning me during the bullpen. They wanted me to go pretty much full out. I was 83, 84, and they're like, okay, that's more where we hoped you'd be. So they sent me to AA that year, having thrown one bullpen with the delivery I was going to use. And I got there, and I was just like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, the pitching coach, he had seen that one bullpen, but every drill that I had worked on for the entire offseason was now different because of the new arm slot.
Yeah, I bet.
And so they... I got off to a good start there. I think I gave up one run in my first 11, 12 innings. They sent me to AAA. Actually had a really bad outing, like my third outing in AAA against Tucson, which was the D-backs AAA. Gerardo Parra was on that team.
Oh.
And
he got you?
Yeah. I don't know if it was – I can't remember if it was a homer. I just remember he hit a ball that was one of the hardest balls I'd ever had hit off me.
Wow.
And I was just like, I gave up like five runs in – 2 1/3 innings or something, and it was a lot different role than what I was in. They were just trying to get me used to the delivery, and I ended up by the end of the season getting on a pretty good run and got my ERA back down under 3 in AAA. And the A's came to me at the end of the year and said, look, if we were in contention right now and had anything to play for, you would get called up and be a September call-up for us. And that was the first time anybody had ever mentioned to me, like, you legitimately deserve to be in the big leagues right now. And so I had a lot of adrenaline, going into that off season, and then right before spring training, I got hit in the head for my second skull fracture. I was playing catch with a guy, back home, and his little nephew was hanging out with us. He's about 10, 12 years old. And we were playing three way where me and the nephew were down on the same end. And he threw the ball kind of, John, the older guy, threw the ball kind of in between us. And the nephew didn't know – we didn't know who it was to.
Right.
And he lunged for it, ticked off the end of his glove, and it consequently made me miss it, and it hit me square in the forehead.
Oh.
And so I've still got this permanent dent right here from – they had asked me about putting a plate in, and I said, is it medically necessary? And they said, no, it's just for looks. I was like, I'm not that pretty anyways. So, let's –
It's a badge of honor, man.
Yeah, so – plus insurance wouldn't have covered it since it was cosmetic. So,
how big
not.
A setback did that turn out to be?
That was in January. It was mid-January when that happened, and I was – I pitched all spring training that year I cut up a piece of a catcher's skull cap and put it inside the front of my hat for spring training just to protect that area from, if I got hit in the exact same spot, it would, potentially have some complications. But other than the concussion and once the fracture healed, I was good to go. And so I didn't miss any spring training time, but I was on a very much regulated schedule, at that point where they, always paying attention, coaches coming up to you, have your guard in, that kind of stuff. And but by the time the season started and I went to AAA, to start the year. I didn't have to wear that guard anymore, and I was good to go.
You were off and running. Do you ever think about using one of the new caps that they always talk about? We've seen some pitchers use that.
I've thought about it because I had a skull fracture in 2004, also in A-ball. Fred Lewis was coming up with the Giants, hit the second pitch of the game, hit a missile back at me right in my right temple, and that put me in ICU for 6 or 7 nights, and that was a lot more scary ordeal than the one in January of 2008.
The 10-year-old.
Yeah. So, but I've contemplated it, but it's with my delivery. If the one right now, you can see when the guy from San Diego wears it.
Alex Torres.
Yeah.
Torres,
it's a little loose on his head. You can see like gaps where the hat is not against his head. Mm-hmm. And with my delivery, the way my head is cocked sideways and stuff, I feel those hats move every single time I throw it.
Oh, so you've tried it.
Yeah. I tried it just, it was either 2 spring trainings ago, I think. McCarthy had a demo of it, and I put it on, and they brought another one in later that spring that I actually threw a bullpen with, and it was just, it just shifted on my head, and I felt like I was thinking about it so much when I was pitching, and I didn't want it to fall off mid pitch, you know, that kind of stuff. So I'm not opposed to it. I could care less what it looks like. Like I said, I'm not that pretty to begin with. So I
none of us are. That's why we're on radio.
But if there's something that comes back that's very functional and also they prove that it's that it does what they say they do, then I'm definitely not opposed to wearing it down the road.
You spent enough time with us. You've been great. I know you want to get out of here. I want to ask you one more thing.
Sure.
About where things are this year, because just walking around and seeing Yasmani Tomas over there hitting and taking grounders and Chip Hale and Tony La Russa, the whole thing. What's the difference? And I know we're not there yet, but what's the difference, sort of the way things feel now versus last year?
I mean, it's a big difference in that there are so many new people here. Like you mentioned several of them, and even guys that haven't shown up here yet, but we know they're new on the team. They're we'll have Greeny in the dugout, the former Double-A manager that he'll be the one of the assistant coaches this year, and there's just several changes that have been made that make you think that, like, we're at least happy with the idea that they weren't content with where we were at. It's our job. Ultimately, it's our job on the field to go out and create the wins. You know, managers can make decisions and general managers can tweak the roster a little bit, but we're the ones out there playing, and there isn't a single guy out there who doesn't have the talent to be at this level. So it's a matter of executing on a night in, night out basis, and that's what we didn't do a good job of, and I think they realized that, and they that's what we're gonna be working hard on this spring.
So you have talked to the new manager, the new coaches, well, with Chip.
Yeah,
him
and Tony have both. When they see me around the complex, they ask, how's it going, how's it feel, and I'm like, arm feels great, knee's coming along, and. And I feel like I'm right where I'm supposed to be, and I hope that based on what they did with the bullpen last year, where they kind of traded the other veteran guys with the exception of Ollie, and Addison's got his 4 years in now, and I think they're looking to me to kind of be a leader down there and kind of be a tutor for Matt Stites and Evan Marshall and guys like that are coming up.
And I think you should. I mean,
yeah,
you've been long enough in the game. I think in the bullpen, you and Oliver are the older guys now, as far as
the veterans. Yeah.
The veterans, yeah.
Yeah,
and plus
weird.
All your work with the, with the union and everything. You're a guy to know around here. There's no question about that.
Well, and I hope everybody is comfortable, with me being in that role, because I love it. And, I hope they learned some from me last year, those guys, when they first came up. And I feel like they were asking a lot of the right questions, and they made big strides throughout the course of the year. And they know, everybody's got room for improvement. Even guys who've been in the big leagues 10 years feel like there's room to improve their game. But those guys, they made big strides. And I think they knew going back home this offseason, the workout regimen's a little different coming into spring this year. You got a little more intensity in your workouts, because that now that you're there, you've got to stay there, and staying in the big leagues is one of the hardest things. Getting there is hard enough, but staying there is even harder.
Is it?
Oh yeah.
Always guys, minor leaguers, trying to take your spot.
The young guns, and we got a bunch of them here this year, that's for sure. Brad, you've been awesome as always. Thanks so much, man.
My pleasure.
Take me out to the ball game.
Let's see what else is happening in the majors these days.
I don't believe what
Time to go around the league.
Around the league, Max Scherzer has a new home finally. 7 years, $210 million from the Washington Nationals, Rodrigo. But what makes this deal so unusual is that half of the 210 is deferred. So for the next 14 years, whether he pitches or not, the Nationals will pay Max Scherzer $15 million a year. He's a Boris guy. You are a Boris client. What do you think about the idea of a deferred salary, a $210 million, half of it is, we'll pay you later?
I like it. As a player, I like it because regardless of what happened, you got your money secured for 14 years. Mm-hmm. Your contract with the Nationals will expire just in 7 years, so you might, you still have some gasoline in your arm. You can go somewhere else. And being Scott Boras guys, I think he make the right step. I mean, Scott is pretty good in what he does, and he does contracts.
He figured out a way to make it good for the team because while they pay Scherzer $210 million, his salary is only $15 million a year, so it doesn't kill him on the luxury tax. And then Scherzer knows he's got the financial security of having that $15 million a year check come in even for years after he retired. What's it like to be a Scott Boras client?
I guess you have someone behind you that will represent you well, but probably the relationship that you will have with him is not like he's not gonna call you on your birthday. He's not gonna send you a card during Christmas. I mean, it's not that type of guy. When you go either to Los Angeles or Anaheim, he always on the suites behind home plate. He will say hi. I mean, a good guy to talk, but you probably never heard probably once a year about it. Once you go to negotiate your contract, I don't feel like he wants to put too much pressure. He don't tell you much about what happened in the negotiation until he got something close to almost get done. So he's the type of guy, a good negotiator, but it's not the
so he doesn't really tell you until it gets right down to the end what's going on.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow, okay. And you like that?
I don't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I like would think. Yeah, wouldn't you want to know? Hey, tell me everything.
No, at one point when I was client of his, I was telling you, I like to know every offer I have from different teams and see what they are. I mean, if I got an offer that you think is not worth my job, I wanted to know that offer. I might like it. And at the end, just like you say, who is the player is the boss, not the agent.
Right. Some other news from around the league real quick. Dexter Fowler goes from the Astros to the Cubs. Colby Rasmus goes from the Blue Jays to the Astros. So Cubs keep acquiring veterans. So does Houston. I still think Evan Gattis is going to destroy that ballpark. Yovani Gallardo goes from the Brewers, the Fort Worth native, to the Texas Rangers for three prospects. And the Giants trying to replace the power they lost with Michael Morse and Pablo Sandoval with speed and defense, they say. So they've got Norichka Aoki now in left instead of Morse and Casey McGee at third base instead of the Panda. Can you replace that much power with speed and defense? I mean, you're not getting a lot of speed out of Casey McGee, and defensively he's fine. But what do you think of what the Giants have done and compared to where they were last year, winning the World Series?
Yeah, probably you can replace the speed power with the speed. But in this case, I don't think it's compensated even. You got Pablo Sandoval, he got power for both sides of the play, very aggressive. And you got Casey McGee, nothing against Casey McGee. He got very good number last year, coming from Japan, made a good job last year. But definitely I really like to have Pablo Sandoval and my team, the Casey McGee, both got good defense. On the outfield, have more, got power, means in a scoring position, make a mistake, you're going to cut you two runs. But with Aoki, you're looking for be careful with got a man on first and don't steal the base.
Well, that's it for this week around the league. Let's get analytical now. It's time for SmackDown.
Well, let me tell you something, brother.
We're ready to smack you over the head with some serious analytics.
Thermodynamics, hypermathematics.
Like a wrestler with a folding chair.
Lay it the smack it down.
It's go time for Sabermetric SmackDown.
Sabermetric SmackDown, our continuing look at some advanced analytics, baseball's new math. This is the segment for you, Leo. If you're not quite up to speed or on board, we pick one stat every week. We run it up the flagpole and see which way the wind blows.
So I'm not up to speed or on board.
I will say, to your credit so far, you have been fairly on board.
I'm trying.
You are. I think you get a passing grade at least. Rodrigo, are you a big sabermetric guy? Do you use that in your broadcasts at all?
And the broadcast, yeah. When I was a player, no.
Yeah. Well, what do you use for the broadcast? What do you look at?
Strikeouts, ground outs versus outs. So
ground ball percentage.
Yeah, the whip.
We talked about whip a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, base walks per nine innings pitch.
Perfect. You walked right into that one because I'm going to tell you why that's a mistake right now.
Okay.
I sound like Brian Kenny. All right. Often, as we've discussed, sabermetrics attempts to value the performance of a player or a pitcher based only on the things he can control, because it then filters out other variables and isolates the performance under a sharper microscope. Last week, we talked about FIP, fielding independent pitching, as a better idea to quantify pitchers' performance than ERA because it takes out things like defense and some other stuff. On this show, let's isolate that pitcher even further and get down to basics: strikeouts and walks. Two ways of doing this, actually three. You can just look at the totals for each pitcher. All right, how many strikeouts for this guy? How many walks for that guy? But there's no context there. How big's the sample size? How many innings did he pitch? Not very efficient. You want a better number than just a counting stat. So instead of a total, let's look at strikeouts and walks as a rate stat. What percentage of batters faced does the pitcher strike out or walk? And that kind of levels the scale a bit. And what you most often see, unfortunately, is what Rodrigo just mentioned. Strikeouts per nine innings pitched and walks per nine innings pitched. Ks per nine, walks per nine. This obviously measures how many strikeouts and walks a pitcher averages over nine innings. Now, what's wrong with that idea? Anybody?
Nothing.
Incorrect. Thanks for playing. Rarely these days does any pitcher throw nine innings at any one time.
Nope.
Last season, Clayton Kershaw led the majors with six complete games. Only 12 pitchers in baseball had more than two complete games. So if that's the case, why would you use a nine-inning scale? Why divide those total strikeouts and walks into nine-inning segments if guys aren't pitching nine innings?
Well, I guess because it's the average, right? The average.
Good. You're with me. That's where we're going. This is nice. This is why we like to look at measuring strikeouts and walks in percentage as opposed to per nine innings. Strikeout percentage and walk percentage. This is the way to go here. It takes into account the fact that some pitchers face more batters every inning than other pitchers do, and so they get more chances to strike out guys or walk guys. So the numbers are a little more fair here. Both strikeout percentage and walk percentage are calculated by using plate appearances and not at bats, and that helps balance things out as well. How often is the pitcher missing bats? How often is he missing the strike zone and walking guys? What you're looking for is a pitcher who generally strikes out twice as many guys as he walks. So as always, we give you context here. What's a good number? What's a bad number? League average strikeout and walk percentage varies year to year. You got to keep that in mind. Last season, the major league average strikeout percentage was 20.4%, and the walk rate was 7.6%. And this is interesting. The major league average strikeout percentage has gone up every year since 2005. So you're talking a decade here. While the league average walk percentage from a pitcher has gone down every year since 2009. So basically, every year last five seasons, pitchers are striking out more batters and walking fewer batters. So are you with me on measuring it as a percentage versus measuring it per nine innings?
But
did I sell you?
I don't know. You don't have to agree.
Don't have to agree at all. That's the beauty of this.
I like the ratio. I like looking at a pitcher's he's struck out, 100 and he has walked 40. To me that is his strike.
But that you mean the total? That's the totals.
Yes, he struck out. He's striking out.
Right, but you don't know
more than two times than 2-1 strikeouts to walks or something like that.
So you just want the total. You just want the total numbers. You're just counting.
Yeah, and it gives
But did a guy throw 100 innings or did he throw 200 innings?
It just tells me that he strikes out more than he walks or okay, he strikes, they're pretty close.
Strikeouts or walks per 9 innings and strikeouts average, right? So are those numbers aren't pretty close? Because
they can be skewed. The idea behind all these analytics is to get a more pure number, to filter out some of the static and some of the noise,
but
and give
we
me
have
a,
to go
an idea of really
inner,
pure
right?
performance.
Like,
right, or you could just do percentage like we do here because it's based on the number of plate appearances that a pitcher faces. So that you start off on a more even frame of reference and go from there.
Then you had to go with the average, with the percentage, I mean.
See? There he is.
Yeah.
He's on board.
He's felt that someone needed to agree with him.
So I just kind of needed a hug. Yeah. All right, league average strikeout percentage last year, 20.4%. Diamondbacks leader in strikeout percentage. League average is 20. Who led the Diamondbacks, pitch starter or reliever, in strikeout percentage? What do you think?
Oliver.
Correct. Boy, he is locked in.
Well, you went to him first.
No, I threw it open to the class. Oliver Perez, 29.7%. Keep in mind, league average 20, so he's doing really well. Will Harris and Addison Reed. Will is now in Houston. Addison Reed just behind. Among starters, both Wade Miley and Chase Anderson, 21% strikeout mark. League average 20, so they're both above. This is where to look for improvement in 2015. Last year, the league average walk percentage, as we mentioned, was 7.6%. The Diamondbacks had 14 pitchers all at 8 or above. 14 guys who had a walk percentage of 8% or higher. So that's got to get better. I'm glad one of you, Leo, I actually swayed a guy with some of this stuff.
That's outstanding.
And a former major league player, Scott Boris yes. Klein. He's no dummy. He knows what's going on. You're back there. I don't know what you're
just
doing.
Still a dummy.
Well, in summary, don't look at strikeouts per 9 and walks per 9. Instead, look at strikeout percentage and walk percentage. You'll get a better read on and a better comparison of which pitchers are recording strikeouts and which are issuing walks. I think we're done, right? Is that it? Episode 6?
That's it. It's a wrap.
You tell me, Leo. You're the master. I just a guest today.
Well,
dude, you
were
fantastic.
I can't thank you enough
for coming down and doing this with
us.
I
had a good time, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it was great. Well, believe me, we'll be nagging you all season long to do this because we're going to take the show on the road once the season starts.
Oh, yeah. I'll be happy to do it. Count on me.
Well, Rodrigo Lopez, our co-host, Brad Ziegler, our big-time guest, want to thank them for stopping by. We'll be back early next week, brand new episode 7. By the way, save the date, February 22. That's a Sunday, 11th annual Subway D-backs Fan Fest at Chase Field, noon to 4. Spring training games right here at Salt River Fields begin Tuesday, March 3rd, a game against the ASU Sun Devils. That'll be fun. Individual spring game tickets have been on sale about 2 weeks now, so you have to move quickly here because those things go fast. dbacks.com/spring for a complete schedule. And while you're on the website, either buying spring training tickets or listening to this podcast, check out all the new season ticket plans, flexible payment plans and options. Pick a weekend plan, a half-season plan, or go all in with full season tickets. That gets you the best seats at the lowest prices. Following the D-backs on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram is always easy. Follow this show on the Twitter at D-backs Podcast. You can tweet us your questions, which we like to read on the show here. The questions have been a little slow coming in. I look to you, Leo, to kind of get that thing going.
I think people have heard me read their questions, and it's not
that was
too
it. They decided I'm out on this deal.
Yeah, if he can't get it right, we're not going to do
well,
it.
Well, either but way, if
give
you
give me another chance.
If you follow us on the Twitter, you'll at least get links to all our shows. We tweet those out and news about upcoming guests. Back next week with episode 7 for Leo Gilmartin and Rodrigo Lopez. I'm Steve Berthume. Thank you, fans, for listening and downloading. We really appreciate your support on this project, and we will talk to you again next week from here at Salt River Field. So long, everybody.
This has been another edition of D-backs Podcast.
The game is over, and the Diamondbacks have got to win here.
Thanks for listening.
It's over. Go home.
We'll see you soon at Chase Field for more D-backs Baseball.